The Legends Radio Network now presents Lyrics and Legends with your host, Jerry Webb.
Well, the program's Lyrics and Legends. This week, we've got a really good one coming up in the studio.
Oh, man,
with
do
us.
We.
Oh, my goodness, Trader Price. And I don't know, people are going to go, Trader who? Trader Price was Roy Orbison's band.
Yeah, the last year Roy Orbison was alive.
The last 5 years, actually.
Yeah, the last five.
Opened for the Eagles, did all kinds of great stuff. Also toured with Reba, and just a lot of great stories we're going to hear coming up in the next hour on Lyrics and Legends. Tell us a little more about it, Buck.
We've been trying to get these guys over here from the big city of Burns Flat, Oklahoma, for about 2 years.
Anybody that loves a little music history is going to love this program. In the studio with us, won't you introduce your you just tell me who they are. What the heck?
Well, let's give everybody the name of the band first.
All right.
We are delighted to have right here in the Legends studio, Trader Price. Now, the Price family I have known for years, and there were five boys. Mm-hmm. I went to college with the older brother named Ron Price. We had a little band in college, but Dan Price is with us. Chris Price is with us. Eric Price is with us. And guys, it is such a pleasure to have you all in this studio. I've seen you guys perform countless times, but we've never done an interview with you as long as I've been in radio, and this is a real honor. Welcome to Shamrock, Texas.
We're excited.
Welcome to Legends 92.9 and the Classic Country Network.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. It's good to be here.
Good to see you guys.
Usually when we kick this off, we try to go back and get a little history of kind of what you guys' influences were and how you got started and where you got started. Why don't one of you take off and tell us a little bit to...
Well, I mean, our connection with music in general. I'm the youngest one, by the way, of the three that are here right now. So Dan, you probably
the baby brother,
this, but he looked at me, so I'm having to talk. But Ron, our oldest brother, Ron, started going to college in '57. Is that right, Buck?
'57.
And that's when you guys met, isn't that right?
We did.
At Southwestern at Southwestern State College, back in the day in Weatherford, Oklahoma, and. So that's, you know, that's really why we're here today, because Ron and Buck got together, they wrote songs, they had a band, Dan joined them at one point after he got out of high school, and we started with all that, and the original influences, you know, Elvis was a huge influence on Ron.
Oh, yeah.
All the rockabilly stuff is what got Ron going, and Buddy Holly, and stuff. Buck knows those influences better than I do, because I was five.
There was a little blues involved in that too.
Exactly.
Ron, when I got to college, and there was a guy, I was talking to him this morning, that lives over in Elk City, named Strawberry Morris, Dwayne Morris, and he's the first guy I met when I went to college, and I said, hey, do you know any guitar pickers around here? I need to get a little band together. And he said, well, there's a kid out at Burns Flat, Ron Price. And so Ron and I were talking, and he got to talking about Elvis and Chuck Berry and Jimmy Reed. Mm-hmm. And I said, man, this could be good.
And they, you know, Dan and Ron had sung around the house quite a bit, and Ron started, you know, picking the guitar up and all that kind of stuff. And I know that Ron and Dan won the 1955 Cordell Talent Show or something with Black Slacks. Remember that one? I don't remember who did it. I was just a kid. But Dan, you should tell more of this because you were there.
Well, Ron would always conjure me into trying to play rhythm guitar with him because he wanted to play lead. And it's kind of hard to learn lead by yourself unless somebody's doing a rhythm and stuff like that. And so he would promise me that he would pitch me baseballs and I wouldn't have to go get them. He'd
go
get them and I'd practice batting. So that's kind of how that, because, you know, I wasn't real interested in the music at the time. But then I did that, and as it went on, Ron and Buck met at college, like they said, and they formed a group called the Velvets. And my mom made them some jackets that were made out of, velvet. Oh, man, they were beautiful. And they won the Freshman Follies that year.
Remember
that?
Yeah.
So, boy, they thought they were a big deal. So they were going to really go out and take the music, you know, a storm, you know. But now it was a lot of fun. And then back in 63, I had started college year before, and they had a band called the Thunderbirds, Ron and Buck and two other guys. And one of the guys got killed in a car accident in the early 63. I don't remember the month. And they asked me if I would just come up and stand on stage because they were getting paid by the man. And I'm serious. And so
he did a good job of standing.
Can't make this stuff up.
Okay? No, you can't.
So I went up and then, you know, started playing a little guitar. I didn't plug it in or anything yet. And then started playing. And then that's the way I got started, and I never stopped.
Yeah, that's how he got going with
that's
it.
The way
and in the meantime, me and Eric were still at home in school, and of course, we were very influenced by you guys, by Ron and Dan and all that kind of stuff. When the Beatles hit in late 63, early 64, I was 10 years old, and that's when it really I loved the Beatles, and Eric and I knew every Beatles song that was ever in existence, and so we did that. Eric ended up, you know, going to Vietnam after he got out of high school and all that kind of stuff. And I finished high school. And the way the three of us actually started playing together, I'm talking about me, Eric, and Danny, I got out of high school and went to college. And Dan called up. He was down in Dallas, had been working with Ron down in Dallas. Eric had just gotten back from Vietnam and out of the Army and was going to school on the GI Bill again at Southwestern. And Dan said, why don't you come down and we'll start a little trio and play our way through college. And that's how the three of us got together.
Now, Eric, you guys call him Joe, though.
Sorry. I
thought we
would always
call
him Joe.
When you guys came in.
I
was like, who the heck is Joe?
But, only count three of them.
Yeah, exactly.
So for people just tuning in, now stay with us because this gets good. These guys, you know, you think you're just hearing about a little band that was from over at Burns Flat, Oklahoma, but there is a ton of stuff that went on with these guys along with some touring with Reba and different things we're going to get into. We always like to get a song in here pretty quick. What do you guys have? Something we can maybe give a little backstory on, or front story on, or how do you do that, Jim? Front or back?
Where we want to begin? Probably a good one that would be interesting, probably to hear, and people are always like to hear. We were a Roy Orbison's band for a long time, in the from 77 through about 82, and Roy. We had a lot of songs, which hopefully we're going to have mastered here in the next two or three months that nobody's ever heard that Roy sang, and of our songs and this and that, that we recorded them in Nashville. But the main reason we had first got with Roy is he wanted to guide our career because he had heard some of our demos and was dying for us to get into his good studio there in Nashville. He had a nice state-of-the-art studio there. And he was just going to be our executive producer for an album. And sort of guide us. Well, in the midst of doing all that, he and I came up with the idea, why don't we do a version of Pretty Woman? And but do it, this was 1977, and do it slow and do a whole different idea on it. And we asked Roy if we could do that, and he said, sure, go for it. And so that's the backstory of this. So we went in the midst of recording our album and recorded Pretty Woman.
All right, so we're going to listen to Trader Price. Is this Trader Price?
Well, it was at the time we were called Squad Row.
Okay. Say that again.
Squadrohiji. Squadrohiji, and it comes from a hydro squeegee. So you should know exactly where that comes from.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to listen to Pretty Woman, and we're going to be back in just a few minutes with Trader Price.
See, pretty woman, that you look pretty woman, give your smile to me. Whoa, pretty woman, yeah, yeah. Pretty woman, won't you look my way? Pretty woman, say you'll stay with me.
Program's Lyrics and Legends,
and this one we may have a trouble keeping this one in between the yellow lines here. I don't know, but the song we just listened to was Pretty Woman. That was Squad Row Heejee's, did I get that right?
That's right, you got
version
it right.
Of Pretty Woman, and it's always fun, man. I just get so much kick. I mean, you look back and you see you got these guys from Burns Flat, Oklahoma, that get hooked up with Roy Orbison and go to Nashville and record this, and it's just starting to get good. It's going to get even better, but I want to hear the story about Buck coming to work on the family farm. So.
Well, you have to realize Ron was from a working farm. Our farm, we had a cotton farm and five boys, and we all chopped cotton and pulled cotton. I've been down on my knees half-mile rows pulling a sack. And, you know, that was tough work. And he was Buck was a city slicker from Shamrock, Texas. Yeah. So anyway, he decides one of the summers between the college semesters that he was going to come out and help at the farm, and he was going to work. And we had a basement down there, and they, you know, it's a good place and all, and we're still waiting on him to go out and do any work.
Well, so
he
are we.
Had to tell he that had story. To tell that story. That's right. Oh, my gosh.
Let's introduce these guys again in case some people just tuned in late. Buck, tell us who we're visiting with.
All right. We have Chris Price here.
Yes, sir.
Grammy Award-winning songwriter. Yeah, a big round of applause. Eric, sometimes known as Joe.
Right. Yeah.
That must be a story.
There is a story.
And Dan Price, who in the days when Dan was with us now, he was Danny Kent.
Danny Kent.
That's right. Yeah. That's he just stood on the stage and looked good. The girls liked him. I might add that.
Nothing wrong with that. There's probably never been anybody get in the music business just because girls, right?
No, that would never happen.
Never happen.
But I'll tell you, Dan ended up learning how to strum that guitar,
yes,
and developed quite a singing voice, and he and Ron did most of the vocals. I sang a few songs that stayed in one key the whole time.
And one note.
Yeah, yeah, whether you're supposed to or not.
You were talking about the Beatles. Dan, you remember we were the house band at a club in Oklahoma City called the Spa Yen Club, across from Tinker Field. And the Beatles were the big thing. So we all went out and bought Beatle wigs. We had the Beatle boots, and we had these gold ascots that we wore around our neck, you know. And we actually had people waiting outside to get in to see. We did a whole set of Beatles songs wearing those silly wigs. And he looked quite stunning in a Beatle wig.
The first time Eric and I ever actually got on stage, I don't know which iteration of the group it was, whether you were with it or whether they were the Fantastics already, because they came that after the Thunderbirds. And they were playing at the ballroom at Southwestern again, same place. And his band was playing there for a dance. And, of course, I was 11 years old, maybe Eric would be about 14. And they wanted us to come up and watch them. And so we did. Well, what'd they do? They pulled us up on stage, and we had to sing Tell Me Why by the Beatles. I don't know if you remember that song.
Yeah.
And If I Fell.
Oh, yeah.
Those were brand new songs at the time. And we had, that was the first time I ever went on stage, scared. I'm not going to say the same word that David Crosby said at Woodstock.
We can edit.
Scared, hoopless. It was what, and all that stuff. But yeah, that was the first time Eric and I ever sang on stage together.
I will have to tell you this, that these two guys here, they, at home, that's all they. I mean, that's not all they did, but in any spare time, Eric had some cardboard boxes and some drumsticks, and he played the drums, and then Chris played piano and played guitar, and they did nothing, but they just knew every Beatles song. They could do it just like the Beatles did it, all the chords, all of the harmonies and everything. It was just amazing. So we had to get them up whenever they came. Every time they were in the audience, we brought them up, and the people just go crazy, because Chris was... He was so little, I mean, even for his age, he was little, and he was only like 10. So people would just go crazy. And Eric always had a great voice. And so it was really fun to bring him up, and people really were impressed with him.
Now, talk a little bit about how you got connected with Roy Orbison.
Well, it's a long story, but briefly, we were trying to get things started. We had moved to Nashville in January of 1976. That was the four brothers, Ron, Dan, Eric, and I. And our other brother joined us, our younger brother joined us about 6 months later. And we were trying to get something going, and we wanted to have some hits. And,
now, let me interject here. We did not do country while we were in Nashville.
No, that's
we
true.
Were doing pop. Whatever the music was that the kids at the colleges wanted to hear.
Right.
And it wasn't country at that time. And so, anyway, go ahead.
We moved to Nashville because Ron and Dan knew some people out there, because Dan had been signed to United Artists back in the 60s, which is a whole other story. But anyway, the way we met Roy is we recorded some demos. Roy's engineer at his studio heard them, took them to Roy, and Roy said, I want to meet these guys. I want to talk to them because I think they've got something special and I want to guide their career.
A lot of times people think that you have a dream and you have a plan. And every time something happened to us that was good, it was never planned.
No.
We did those sessions up in Kentucky. A guy come in there, just was a guy at the club. And he said, I've got a recording studio. You guys want to come in and record? I'll let you record free. Well, that's something for a band, especially at that point in our career. So we went in, and it just so happened it was about 100 miles from Nashville. And the Roy's had a studio down there called U.S. Studios, real popular studio. And Ronnie Millsap bought it whenever he sold it. But the engineer down there also, on the weekends a lot of times, would do work for himself. And so he would go up and he would level all, put the tape in that levels all of your gauges and all that kind of stuff. And our 32-track, or whatever it was sitting there, wasn't rolled up because he had already taken it off. He put it back on. He thought, I wonder what this thing sounds like. And he punched it, and it was us. And so he asked this guy if we'd be all right for him to take that back to show Roy. And so he did.
That's how it came about.
Just so lucky.
Wow. That's,
we had it all planned. No.
Yeah, that was all planned.
Now you guys toured. Y'all were
Roy's band. We went into his studio and started working on it was just our stuff with us singing and us writing because he had heard, he liked the music that we had had on that demo. So we went in and started doing that. And he, about 4 months, 5 months later, he calls us up on end of June in 1977 and said, "Would you guys like to go out on the road with me as my band? I just fired everybody." He said he was in Vegas and he had gotten fed up with what was going on. Evidently, he says, "I've got one guy I want to keep on my band, but would you guys consider going out and being my band?"
How long did it take you to?
Well, it actually took us quite a while because we had some real good stuff going. You just played one of the things that we were that we were doing, Pretty Woman, and there's a lot of other stuff that was really, really good. By the way, that version of Pretty Woman, when Roy heard it in the studio, and after we'd had it finished and everything, he said, "That is the best version of one of my songs I have ever heard." He said, "Including my own recordings."
Wow,
that's what he said. Yeah, pretty high compliment.
Very high.
He said, we were really wanting to get ourselves going, but we talked it over and decided it would be nice to have some actual concert experience rather than just playing the clubs, which is what we had always played. And
also, let me interject this. We knew we needed stage experience, mm-hmm. but we were able to talk him into letting us front every show he did. Okay. So we would be us, and then we'd go back and put on these pirate uniforms that he made us wear. And we would come out, and so nobody recognized us because we didn't look the same. Yeah. But that is so really weird.
We started going out on the road with him, and in doing that, he became a lot more comfortable with us in a lot of different ways. Roy was Wink, Texas boy. He's West Texas.
Wink.
And Wink, Texas, yeah. And
there are rumors that a lot of people believe really strongly around here that he was born at Kelton and then his birth certificate was registered.
It would not surprise me at all. When we first met Roy, we'd met a number of people in the business already, but there was just something, there was a lot of simpatico there. He was a lot like us. He had worked hard growing up. He was very humble and very, all the things that we liked about people.
Kind of like Joe over here.
Exactly, like Joe over here who talks
just
all the time.
Just can't get him to shut up.
And he was just a great guy. And as we got out on the road with him and being out there, you're with him, around him all the time, we just became very, very good friends.
Yeah, he's a great
guy. And he wanted to start writing with us. And that's how our career really got going in that respect, is because we started writing with Roy.
So if we wanted to throw another song in here, which we try to do every so often, mm-hmm. so maybe I'm thinking we could do one you wrote that Roy mm-hmm. recorded with.
Yeah, the one that everybody's heard before. After we'd been with Roy for about 3.5 years, he and I wrote a song called "That Loving You Feeling Again." And it was originally just going to be Roy singing it, and it was going to be in a movie. It was in a movie called Roadie. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that. It's an interesting movie. Meatloaf was the star of it. But they wanted us to write that. And I had written the first verse and chorus about a year before that, which is a whole other story. And we hadn't showed it to anybody. And he said, "Put that away," because his word for things when he really liked it, he said, "That verse and chorus is glorious." That was his word,
glorious.
And he said, "Put that some special place, and I'll holler at you when we want to finish it." So he called us up and said, first of all, we're going to go out on tour with the Eagles for 8 dates on the East Coast, on the West Coast. They're doing the long run tour, and we're opening 8 dates for them. Plus, they wanted to do this song for this movie. He said, "You remember that thing you showed me down in Muscle Shoals?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I got it." And he said, let's work on that. So I went out and we holed up together for 2 or 3 days in a hotel out in L.A. And we were about 95% done with the song because Roy had Roy's method of writing was its own thing. And he got a call and the producer of who was going to produce the soundtrack for it said, "Would you like to do a duet?" And Roy said, "Well, I'm not going to do a duet with just anybody. You know," he said, "if you can get Linda Ronstadt or Emmylou Harris or somebody, yeah, I'd probably do a duet." And I remember he got off the phone because we were in there writing at the time, and he looked at me and he says, "Podno Canosi, we may have to make this a duet." So that's why he always called me Podno Canosi. I don't know where that came from. and the guy told him, "I'll get right back with you." And he called Linda, and she was out on tour. And he called Amy Lou, and she said, I'll be there whenever you want me there.
Wow.
And so he said, yeah, we got to make a duet. So we switched it around and did a few things to it to make it a real duet. And did the tour with the Eagles on the West Coast, did 8 dates out there, 4 in L.A., 2 in Oakland, 2 in San Francisco. He and I flew back to L.A., met with Emmy Lou Harrison. You know, I thought this was a radio show, and you can't see this, but it was very unnerving. We'd already met a lot of really big people at that point in time.
A lot of people like Roy.
Loved him. Everybody loved him. You know, we'd played in front of the Eagles. This is way before that. And everybody, Beach Boys and the whole bit. So, but he says, okay, we're going over to Emmy Lou's house, and we're going to show her the song. I just had a little Wurlitzer electric piano, you know, and Roy's over there, and I'm having to sing Emmy Lou's part now. You know, and of course we knew it had to be in at least not a normal guy's range. I mean, you know, some of it was. So I'm having to sing the harmony, which we had worked out. And it was so unnerving because I'm sitting there playing and I'm singing it. And she had a little, one of those little handheld cassettes. Remember those back in the 1980? And a little handheld cassette was recording it. And she had her ear about 3 inches away from my mouth. Now, you don't think that's a little unnerving? I mean, first of all, I wouldn't want Buck that close, you know, much less.
Especially Buck.
And she's listening real intently to what I'm doing. And we went through it twice and left and came back the next day. And I got to sit in the actual vocal booth when she and Roy did the song. And, I mean, she
nailed it.
She was stunning.
Yeah.
I mean, she really.
All right.
There's one other aspect of this song that I want to say something about. It may not mean anything to you guys, but for some reason at the time, it was weird. Right after that, there were, 18 or so artists that did the soundtrack on this thing?
That's right.
Okay. We go over to, we're fixing to go over to Europe, and we're going to do England and a bunch of places over there. And they had told him at that time that we think this is going to be the first release off of this movie. This is before it ever even came out, I guess.
Well, that was the crazy thing about that to us is we knew who else was on the, Cheap Trick was really big at the time. They had a song on it. Eddie Rabbit had a song, Driving My Life Away, was all from right. that same movie. Blondie had something on it. Jerry Lee Lewis. There was just 18 well-known artists were on this thing, and you know they said it's going to be the first single off this album. We're thinking, and we hadn't even heard it, not even heard it yet.
We
left immediately after we recorded. I went home, got married the next day, and left for England the next day for six weeks.
So anyway, we were over there, and at that time, Roy had me doing kind of the road managing on, so I'd have to go out, and so anything that was business, he'd. You know, he won't talk to me about it. So anyway, we had been over there for 6 weeks or so, and we were fixing to fly back. It was going to, you know, 3 or 4 days later. And he said, Dan, he said, I just got a call today, and we're going back. We got a hit over in the States. I said, what? What hit?
Exactly,
you know, and he said, Loving Your Feeling Again. They said, it's a hit. Well, Roy hadn't had a hit in like 10 or 15 years.
Oh, wow.
He hadn't had anything. And when we would go at that time, you know, there were places that he could draw a whole lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
But Canada, I mean, he could sell out a 5,000-seat auditorium 3 or 4 nights in a row. You could go across to Buffalo, which is American, and you might have 700-800 people.
Right.
Because Americans are real fickle. And so, you know, unless you're hot right then, don't know. Well, all of a sudden, his career just went bazooka. That was great for him, you know, and it was really a good deal. But anyway, I thought, got a hit. Coming back over, you know, because it was changing everything.
Yeah.
Because we were just driving around doing this. And then when we'd go to Europe, there's a lot of different venues over there. They just go. He'd have to do, 3 or 4 encores on each song.
Every song, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
and he was still as big over there.
If you've never heard an encore on one of his songs, what he did was like, you know, then all at once you were standing there. You know, that part. Okay. Well, and he'd go up to real high at the end on all of his songs. And, I mean, people would be going, and they'd just keep clapping. So what he would do is then he would look at
he'd nod at Eric and say, let's start it again.
Eric, start again. And then he'd go, then all at once. We'd go start at the same place at the ending, and he'd go higher.
Oh, wow.
And then, man, their hair would just stand up out there, you know. And so then it stopped, and they wouldn't stop clapping until he did it again. He'd go higher again. Than what he was.
Oh my gosh.
It was amazing, his encores.
And Roy was the type of guy that, you know, we've played with a lot of different people. We've been on stage with Reba and Garth Brooks and Alan Jackson and all Eagles, you know, all these kinds of things like that. But I guarantee you, we played for him for five years doing the same basic show all the time. And every night the hair would stand up on the back of your neck.
It did.
That's how you've never heard
Roy unless you've heard him live.
Nope.
That's just, you know how that worked. Isn't it?
We're going to listen to Loving You Feeling again. We're going to be back and visit with Trader Price. And, man, this is a good one, Buck.
Oh, wow. I told you these guys were going to be good.
Wish you could have talked them into coming earlier, but yeah. Like 2 years ago. We'll be back
I had to work till four.
So. Oh, okay. We'll be back with more right after this.
Saw you standing there on the street. I found myself by your side. I started wanting you again. There's just no way to hide from that old loving you feeling again. It's really got me reeling again. It only seems to stop to start all over. You always get that certain look in your eye. You're not easy to resist, but I just walked on by with that old
program is Lyrics and Legends. I don't know if you can hear all that goofing off in the background, but we have a wild and crazy crowd. I want to talk to Brother Eric a little bit here and see if we can get him in on the conversation. And you joined the band as the drummer when you were how old?
I was just gotten out of the Army. I was about 22, yes, sir.
Well, thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
And then you come home and they're like...
Yeah, went back to school, and that's when they got the idea to have a three-piece. I had never played drums before, just cardboard boxes. That's all I'd ever played.
Yeah.
So we acquired a set of drums, borrowed a set of drums. And one of the funny things about it, we got rehearsed, what, 2 weeks or a week?
No, it was six times.
Six times?
Six.
We knew about and, 12 songs.
Yeah, 12 songs. And a club wanted us to play. And they called me, and I said, no, I'm not going to go over there.
He did.
And I did. They really didn't know where I was going to show up or not, you know. But I thought, yeah, probably better. But
probably better. We really didn't know. I'm serious. I didn't know
we didn't.
Show.
And this old rickety set of drums that I was using. We played at this one place not long after that. It was called The Spot. And it was a hangout for all the hippies and all that. Because this was, yeah, in Weatherford. And it had a sunken dance floor. And we came in there and set up, and then here all of a sudden it starts filling up. And the dance floor is completely full of people sitting down. And they're right in front of us like this, you know. And, of course, we're not real confident at the time.
We were.
And so we started out with Nowhere Man by the Beatles.
He's a real Nowhere. Because our best part was our harmonies. We knew that. Yeah. And so we started out, let's do our something that we're strong at, you know.
Right.
Go ahead, Joe. I was just going to tell them what that started.
No, but anyway, let's talk about embarrassing. this old rickety drum set I had, you know. Well, Nowhere Man started out with the vocals, and then I would hit the snare, and then we'd start. The snare fell off into a girl's lap right in front of the row. And I'm very inexperienced at the time. I didn't know I have any idea what to do. So I just used my tom for my snare the rest of the
day. Me and Dan looked around like, what the heck is going on? Because there's no snare in that dang thing. You know, it's a rock and roll song.
Pardon me, ma'am. Can I get my
snare? I want to add a little bit to that. We, whenever the guy called from the club, I said, we don't have a band yet. He said, I heard you guys had a band. I said, we don't have a band yet. We've only been together six times. We know like 10 songs. And he said, well, you got to be better than what we had last night. And I said, no, you don't understand. We just, you know, we just learning these instruments and all. And he said, I'll pay you $75.
Yep.
That's 25 apiece. At that time, that was pretty good, actually, believe it or not. And it's 1971.
Better than picking cotton.
It was better than picking cotton. Better, yeah. Watching Buck sleep in the basement. So anyway, I said, so you're telling me we come over there, we may not be worth a flip, and you're going to pay us $75.
We have to play the same 10 songs over and over.
Yeah, over and over. I said, we don't know, you know. And he said, you bet. You just come on tonight. That was on a Saturday night because they'd fired the band they had last night, but the night before. We went over there, and we played for the rest of the summer out there.
But we really didn't know if Eric was going to show
and,
up.
No, we
did. I did not think he would.
He finally come walking in at the last. But
set up his old rickety drums, and the rest is history.
That was our first job ever.
First gig ever, the three of us, yeah.
Well, when you get Joe to talking, or get Eric, also known as Eric, does a pretty good job.
He does.
Talking, doesn't he? Pretty good storyteller.
Yeah. Man, a few words, but you better listen when he talks. Yeah. It's that way. Yeah.
So you guys, okay, you did the deal with Roy Orbison for 5 years or so, mm-hmm. and then moved on. And I know you guys were with, or I believe, if Buck's stories tell me right, y'all played with Reba McEntire. Tell me some of the other, you know.
We had known Reba for a long time, back in probably when we first moved back in 79, 80, right in that area, because we were still working with Roy when we moved back to Oklahoma. And one of our best friends, him and his wife, went to school with Reba. In fact, Sherry Field is her name, and she was best friends with Reba at Kiowa schools from first grade through 12th. They were best friends, and Terry had moved down there when he was in the seventh grade and become great friends. Well, they obviously followed her career and getting started, at, you know, with singing the national anthem and all that kind of stuff. And at the time we moved back, Reba was not, she was still Reba McEntire. She wasn't just Reba. At that point, you know, she was starting to have a few hits. She was with Mercury and was having a few hits, not huge hits, but, and she was playing all the rodeo circuits around. That's what she was doing. And she would play, you know, Hinton and Elk City and all these different places with her and her group. And every time she would come this area, we'd all get together. You know, I mean, me and I'm sure Eric and Danny were there, and and we'd all just get together and have a big steak, you know, at Terry's house and just hang out. Well, they had come out and heard our band. Of course, again, we were doing pop music at this point in time. So, you know, they loved to come out and listen to us, and they would listen to our band and this and that. And of course, her career just kept building and building and building and getting bigger and bigger. And she signed with MCA, and I think it was 85 or 86, and it just really got big then because they really were marketing her correctly. And we had gotten away from Roy to get back. You know, we were no longer with Roy, but we had our own little small 8-track analog recording studio there in Burns Flat. And we're recording some demos and this and that. And she, Terry Field, the friend of ours, said he was listening to it, you know, and he'd want to hear everything we did. And he'd just say, stuff's unbelievable. And finally he said, can I put this stuff together and send it to Reba? And by that time she was married to Narvel Blackstock, which was her husband at the time. And we knew Narvel as well because he had been her steel guitar player. And we knew Narvel fairly well, and said, sure, you know, it's not really country stuff. I mean, you know, but by that time the pop music had turned into rap music. The precursors of rap music. And so much it was the techno stuff and story songs and good harmonies and what we thought of as strong songs were not what was going on at the time.
Right.
We knew we didn't fit in very well in that. And so the stuff we were writing, the only place it had a chance to fit in was in the country field, basically, because it was story songs and you know, had a lot of changes and a lot of good harmonies and a lot of stuff like that. So they sent it to them, and they called us immediately and said, man, this stuff's great. Can we take it to Jimmy Bowen at MCA? And that was her producer, and he was the president of MCA. And we said, no, don't do that. So they took it and called us almost immediately and said, you know, Bowen wants to talk to you guys. He wants to see you. So it was December of probably 88, maybe. I don't remember what year it was, somewhere around there. And we went out and met with Bowen. And, of course, Reba and Narvel were there, too. And we sat and talked to Bowen for a long time. And he said, let's do this. And so that's when we got our deal with, at that time, it was with Universal Records, because Bowen had just, his contract was up at MCA. And he had formed Universal Records under the MCA umbrella just for him. And we were one of his first signing bunches.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how did that lead? Did you tour with Reba?
Yes, we did. We did the album. We did, actually, we went in and did four songs at the beginning, and we didn't realize it, but it was a trial to see if we could do this stuff good. And we recorded four songs, and Bowen says, yes, let's go in and finish, do an entire album, you know, and get this album done. And we started, Reba and Narvel said they signed us to their Starstruck. Entertainment, and they signed us, and they wanted to manage us and do all that kind of stuff, and so we signed with them and went out on tour with them for 50-60 dates.
Yeah,
right through there. Right as our album
their
came
plane
out.
Went down. I mean, you know, when wow. they lost their band, we had an old a Ford van with a horse trailer.
Yeah, that's what yeah. we our equipment was in. Yeah.
And what did they call
us? Trailer mice.
That's what they call us, trailer mice.
Yeah.
You know, they'd go out in these big old tour buses.
17 semi-trucks and
tour buses,
you name
and
it.
All. And here we'd come right after them. Boy, they're an old deal, and they call us trailer mice.
Yeah. We hoped that was an affectionate.
Yeah. I bet it was. You know. Yeah. But you talk about Jimmy Bowen. Now, I haven't heard his name in quite a few years, but this is an interesting story you guys will get a kick out of. When Ron and I recorded White Bucks and Look at Me out at Norman Petty Studios, well, Petty told us that I had this group in here that had a big hit out called Party Doll, yeah. Jimmy Bowen, Donnie Lanier, and Buddy Knox.
Exactly.
And Norman Petty told Ron and I, he said, you know, I had to teach all those guys how to play their instrument. Took them 56 hours to get a master.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and so we went in, and Bowen actually produced our CD. We always had horrible timing in this business. I mean, you know, timing was really bad for us, and not that we didn't probably make some mistakes in our decisions. You always do, but things really worked bad. The first single off that album was a song called Sad Eyes, which you guys have as well here, and it was one of the first things we ever recorded out there. And at the time, country music was pretty traditional. And this thing was
give
a little...
Give me a time period again. So
say 88?
Okay, 88.
It was just starting to turn. to a little bit with a little bit more pop influences, you know. But it was very traditional, and so we recorded Sad Eyes, and it had a distorted guitar intro, and it was a pop song. Remember the old song by Robert John? Sad Eyes Turn the Other Way. That was the one we did. We did a country version of Sad Eyes, and the promotion people heard it for Universal Records and said, oh my gosh, this is the direction country music needs to be going. This is what we have been waiting to get. And usually it takes you 6, 8, 10 months to ever get a single out. We recorded it, and 2 weeks later it was out.
Wow.
They didn't even have any pictures of us. They didn't have any promotional stuff. But the promotion people said, we have got to get this out to the radio stations. This is where country music is headed, and we can be at the start. So they did. They put it out there, and there were, you know, roughly 200 Billboard stations, 220 or whatever it was. Half of them said, put it on their playlists and just were playing the fire out of it. And the other half of them said, this is really good. Why did you have to do a pop song? And they wouldn't put it out. They wouldn't put it on their station.
Yeah, they wouldn't.
So the song did okay, but only half the stations would play it. You know, and there was nothing in the record stores or anything yet, because we had no product. So, you know, it got up to about 50 or so and did okay. But the next song was a song we had written called Lately Rose. And this is back to the bad timing thing. We go in and re-record it. It's a song that we wrote. And you know, it was more country sounding than Sad Eyes was. But we go in, do a video for it, the whole bit, and we finally, you know, get everything done. And this is probably mid-November of 89, I would guess by now. And they put the video out immediately. And that was back when CMT was where all the videos were. Remember CMT, Country Music Television? That's what it was on there. In the first week, the video went to number one.
Wow.
Number one. And Dan and I had, since we're the ones who do a little more talking than Eric does, Reba and Narvaland had us.
I noticed.
They had me and Dan call all the Billboard stations. That was just part of the deal. We'd get in their offices, and we would call every Billboard station and try to talk to the program manager, music director, whatever. And we had called on Sad Eyes, and we'd get to talk to some of them. We'd be on hold for 30 minutes on some of them. It took forever to get through them all. But we started calling all these Billboard stations after Lately Rose was released to the stations. And they had immediately put us through to the program director, and the guy would say, congratulations, guys, this is your first top five record. He said it could be number one. And every guy we got, you know, we're used to rejection. I mean, you just are. You are used to rejection in the music business. It's what it is. And every cotton picking guy we got said, this is where country music needs to be. This is a top five smash song. Congratulations.
Number one video on CMT.
Number one video on CMT.
Yeah, so we thought, wow.
And you know, and they're adding it, and I don't know if, you know, I don't know how they do it nowadays, but back then you were added in heavy rotation, medium rotation, and what was the other, light is what they called it. Mm-hmm. They were adding this thing in heavy rotation. You know, usually you're lucky to get in light. And they were playing it, you know, 8-10 times a day, and it just starts shooting up the charts. And so middle of December, this is after it's actually been out the radio stations probably a month, and it's really, really starting to shoot up, and the music video is going crazy. Narvel calls us, and he said, I just talked to Jimmy Bowen. And he says, I got good news and bad news. This is the timing thing I'm talking about. He said, I got good news and bad news. Good news is Lately Rose is a smash hit song, hands down, smash hit. Bad news is Universal Records does not exist anymore. And Narvel said, you know, he probably had a few expletives, but he just said, what? You know? and Bowen says, I've been real disgruntled with the distribution that MCA is doing for me, because that was part of his deal. They would distribute it through MCA. And he had made some enemies, surprisingly, over the time. And so they were sort of undercutting him. And he says, I just signed a deal with Capitol Records, and I'm the president of Capitol Records now. And everybody, all the promotion, everything, distribution, the whole bit, that song has none of it anymore.
Ouch. Gone.
And he said, you can do one of two things. The guys can stay with MCA, because our contract was by title with MCA, because Universal was an MCA company. We can stay with that. He says, I don't know what they'll do with your record. I have no idea what they'll do. That's what Bowen said. He says, or you can go to me with me, and I'll bring the guys over to Capitol with me, and it will kill your record.
Wow.
And they called us up, and that's what they told us. That's what they, you know, they said, here's what Boyne just said. What do you guys think we ought to do? And we said, isn't that why you have managers? To figure out what the best thing is to do. We've been guiding our own career, and, you know, it hasn't gone so well. And so he and Narvel and Reba talked it over for a week before they decided what they were going to do. And they finally decided, well, Boyne is the person who signed us. Let's go over to Capitol with him.
But it killed the...
Killed the first hit record.
Yeah, it's gone.
And it was a smash hit.
Right. We need to probably listen to that, don't we?
Yeah,
Buck?
He's got it.
Let's put an ear on that
one. All right. So we're going to listen to...
Lady Rose.
Lady Rose. And we'll be back with Joe and Trader Price here in just a few minutes. I'm going to get something out of him before this is over. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Heard an old song on the radio just a few days back. It was our song. We used to sing along. That was before we lost track. Lately, Rose, I've been thinking about you. Maybe we could get back what we knew not so long ago. Were the bad times really so bad when you think of what we almost had? Lately, Rose, I've been thinking about you. Right by the old house, down on Clark Street, the one we worked on so long. And all those flowers we set out for hours, just like you, Rose, they're gone. What we
programs, Lyrics and Legends. So many different people from our area that got involved in the music business. This one tonight is really unique. This group from the little town of Burns Flat, Oklahoma, called Trader Price. And some of the stories we're getting to hear, Buck, are just...
Oh, this is a very special interview for old Buck here, I'll tell you. Even though Joe's not talking too much, you know.
We need a webcam or something, don't we? So we can get Joe in here. But these guys, the song we just played was Lady Rose, and you guys talked about that a little bit. We're going to run out of time here, which it's always happens, but we want to get something here. Chris, you were talking about you guys signed a little later on with a Texas music label.
We did. There was a label called Rodeo X out of Fort Worth, and we played a club there called Rodeo Exchange down in the Cowtown on Fort Worth.
I saw you guys there.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. And
didn't even know you were there.
Yeah.
My brother and I walked into this place in Fort Worth, and we're sitting back there talking, you know, and looking at the girls and whatnot. And I look up on the stage and, my God.
There's my brothers.
There's Trader Brad.
And they've got a real drummer.
And they've got a real drummer now. Yeah. And his drums are staying on his stands. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, we signed. The guy there loved our band, and he had you know, kicked around the idea many times of starting an independent label. And at that point in time, so many of the regular stations had gone totally satellite, and there were still a lot of Texas stations that did stuff like this and did local programming. And so there was the Texas charts. I don't even know if they still exist.
Oh, yeah. They
do. But, you know, Pat Green and a bunch of those guys got their starts on those Texas charts. And we signed a deal with them and went to Nashville and recorded a CD, and we called it Trader Price. And it's we were trying to write something specifically for the Texas market. And so I had the idea of writing a song called Texas Girl. And it was, you know, it's one of our most requested songs. I mean, we continued to play until 3 or 4 years ago, and every night we'd get a bunch of requests for Texas Girl. And so that's, you know, that's one that we did.
All right, we're going to listen to Texas Girl, and we're going to be back in a few minutes, and I think we're going to have to wrap this up, maybe visit the Department of Shameless Plugs here coming up. We'll be back right after this.
Country, shorter hours, bigger money. Spent my life never knowing what I've missed. There's something down there, must be something in the air or in the water. Farmer's daughter, such a creature I never knew to exist. She got Houston in her bonnet eyes, Boston, the way she walks. San Antonio in her smile, Amarillo in the way she talks. She's a Texas girl, a Texas girl, welcoming you to her Texas world. Before you know it, you're in love, bigger than Dallas, just the way it is with a Texas. Girl,
Well, the program is Lyrics and Legends. This has been something that we wanted to do since we started the station, and we're about 60-something episodes in, 69. If it makes you feel any better, y'all are our 69th interview. Buck, I'm just going to throw it to you from there.
All right. I know these guys, you know, and they always have a great time. Now, have you got a funny story of something that's happened on the road to you guys?
One of the, you know, we were farm kids. I mean, even though we had been in the music business and everything, we're still, you know, we know the business end of a hoe handle really, really well back then. And we're pretty much country bumpkins like most people from this part of the western Oklahoma, western Texas. I mean, the good, greatest people in the world. But we were not the most
sophisticated
would be the right word. And we had just joined Roy. And we went out to L.A. Actually, to San Diego was our first job that we played with Roy. His first time he had been on the West Coast in over 10 years. He had played some overseas and a bunch of stuff, but he had never played the West Coast since then. And we played a job in San Diego, and it was fine. It was our first time ever, and we're doing all these brand new songs to us as far as playing goes. And Roy's songs were very sophisticated. They sounded easy, and they were not. It was that simple. And we're struggling to get through all this stuff, but we were opening for the show. Well, the second show we did was in Santa Monica, and thank heavens we didn't know this, but we go out on stage and we do our opening thing, and we did three or four original songs of things we'd recorded in Roy's studio, and we did a Beach Boys medley, which was the biggest thing that we did live. We'd been doing it for a number of years, did a Beach Boys medley. And we did, and we closed the show with Hotel California, which was also one of the best, biggest songs. We still did that back in, that's another song that people constantly requested, was Hotel California. And so we do those things, and we rush off stage to go get into our pirate outfits for the second half of the show. And the promoter comes in, and his eyes are as big as half dollars, and he says, "You guys got to have the biggest cojones in the whole world." And we're going, "What? You know, what do you mean?" And he said, "The Beach Boys were in the audience. The Eagles were in the audience. All of them.
All of them."
He said, "If you guys hadn't nailed it perfectly, they'd have booed you off stage."
Yeah.
And so we're in the deal, and I'm already down to my underwear getting ready to get on my outfit, and the guy comes back in because they're still hollering out there. We just walked off and started changing our clothes, you know. And the guy says, "You got to get back out there." I mean, you know, I didn't even know what an encore was. We didn't have any idea. We would never dreamed that something like that would happen. And so we just, you know, we were already undressed and everything. And we just said, "No, we can't go out." Well, Ron, our oldest brother, had gone back and gotten him a cup of coffee, you know, and Ron had him a cup of coffee. Well, he is over in the wings, and he sort of sticks his head out, drinking a cup of coffee, and people are going, "Yay!" You know, thought he was coming back. No, Ron, you know, country bumpkin, takes a swig of coffee and walks off.
Yeah, okay, Eric, real bumpkin here, right here. The airbag says, get back out there, you know. So I walk out there, and I'm the only one there, and I stand up on my drum stage, and I held up my stick. Everybody goes, "What?"
Yeah. We looked like a wander. You know, we were lost. We were just wandering around.
It was insane.
Yeah, no doubt. But the funny thing about that, too, I thought, or we all thought, was when we were trying to figure out what to play for that show, because, you know, we're out here in Santa Monica. This is a hip place and all this. Let's do a little Beach Boys, because they'd probably like that, you know. And let's do some Eagles. We'll do the Eagles, too. And they'd like that, you know, because we're trying to get something that they might like. And what we didn't know is if we had done it wrong, they'd have booed us off stage. That's what that guy told us.
That's what he told
us. We never even thought of that.
We'll
just do something they might like.
That's great. We have, to wrap this up, we have a long-standing tradition. We're going to get background music in front of this drum roll or whatever. The Department of Shameless Plugs. There we go. So you guys can talk about, I know you've got some of your music being remastered. You've got things. I don't know if you're touring now or... I've got a little.
This is a radio tour right here.
But you guys can talk about. This is your chance to plug whatever you want to plug.
We drove all the way here from Burns Flat. Now, come on. You don't think we're touring?
Have you got the Ford van and the horse trailer?
I got a brand new pickup. That's what I've got. But no, we actually hung it up about 3.5 years ago. We'd continue to play all the time until about 3.5 years ago. And we had always said, me and Eric and Danny had always said, over the last 15 years we played, if any one of us says we're done, we're all done. And it came to that point that we had had to take an unexpected break because the guy who's playing guitar with us had to take a 6-month break. And when we got ready to go back, Eric said, I'm done. And I said, I'm done. And Dan says, okay, we're done.
Yeah, we're done. Well, we didn't want to
continue. So we have nothing to plug.
Not being able to do what we had always done and do it at that level. Mm-hmm. And we realized that we probably couldn't do that anymore. So
although we have a good friend of ours has got some really high-tech mastering equipment, which is too technical for people to probably understand what that is. But it takes your songs, no matter when you recorded them, and make them sound like they should have sounded, you know, because a lot of stuff deteriorated and sure. quality and this and that. And it makes them sound as good as they can sound. And he heard that I was wanting to try to get that done. And he had just bought a bunch of mastering equipment. So basically what I've done is gone back over our entire catalog and picked out 129 songs. I probably have 200 more to give him. And he has them right now, and he's working on them.
And these are songs that nobody's heard.
Yeah. In fact, if you guys want, when we get some of that back, we can bring you a couple of songs that Roy Orbison did that are good that have never been heard by anybody.
That would be great.
I know. To wrap this up, I know you've been with Reba, you've been with Roy Orbison, the Eagles, but one highlight of the Trader Price career had to be playing the St. Patrick's Day dance.
It did, right here.
You guys played that twice, didn't you?
Three times. Okay. Well, maybe I was too drunk on green beer that one time, and I forgot about it.
How many times did you play, Joe?
That's why they don't let me talk. I can't remember this.
We'll go with whatever the crowd
is. Yeah, two or three. Yeah. It might have been two.
We had a number of people that when we'd play at Elk City at the Country Palace or at the Spurs, they would come from Shamrock to listen to us.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There'll be some of them members.
Well, man, we want to thank you guys for so much for taking time to come to the world headquarters of the Legends Radio Network and to come visit with us. We really enjoyed getting to visit with you and get a little bit of the history of Trader Price. Buck, thanks for dragging these guys over here.
Well, I've been working on these guys like for what, 2 years now?
It's been a while, yeah.
You know, I've been to see them several times, but they have come to see us, and guys, we appreciate it. This was a blast having you in the studio.
It was fantastic.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Gary, Jim. Thank you.
This has been another edition of Lyrics and Legends with Gary Ware. Join us next time on the Legends Radio Network.